listening to The History of Religions and Their Gods. And I am your host, the skeptical ghost heathen. For this trip, I highly advise a bag of Cheetos and a headlamp. Hello, heathens. Welcome back to the show. Thank you guys for listening, and a couple of things to talk about, and first and foremost is thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of my black heathen heart. You guys know what I'm talking about. The last 6 weeks of my life have been full of drama and broken ribs and friends getting murdered and all that kinds of good stuff. But thank you for the messages. I received them. The outreach of love has been overwhelming, and life is real, man. You only get one shot at it. Make the best of it as you can. For some of us, it gets taken away early, and we don't get a chance to do the things that we really wanted to do. So embrace it. Embrace this life. Embrace those who you love. Let them know how you feel about them today. But me, just my broken ribs, well, it's going to be 6 weeks, I believe, tomorrow. I am out running a little bit here and there. I'm still training for a marathon. I'm doing Mountains to Beach Marathon, which is in Southern California here. And that's going to be on May 21st. So hopefully I'll be able to get up to at least a 20-mile run, so I'll be prepared for it. But I hope you're enjoying this series of episodes that we're doing here. Actually, I'm calling them chapters. We're talking about the Homeric epic, the Gospel of Odysseus, right? Mark's Homeric epic and the Gospel of Odysseus. I know that I keep posting it on my Facebook and my Christian friends don't respond and say anything about it or want to ask any questions. But it's pretty interesting. All coming from Dennis McDonald's book, The Gospel of Mark and the Homeric Epics. And my spin on it, of course. So I hope you guys are enjoying it, and nothing else to talk about here, but let's get going, and if I think of something else, I'll bring it up at the end of the show. Oh, talking about the book, The Jesus Axiom. For those of you who follow me on social media, I am writing a book. We're about 42 pages in, not we, I am about 42 pages in, about three chapters in. And basically, we're talking about all the different point of views on the Jesus character. From the traditional view, to the Roman conspiracies, to the Homeric epics, you name it. We're talking about everything, laying out all the evidence that we have for all these different points of view. And then we're going to shoot holes in them, or support their theories. And then at the end of the book, I'm going to provide my theory on the whole matter, and I think most of you that are listening to my show already know where James's head is at, right? Or the heathen's head is at. But I think it's going to be interesting to lay it all out, and we all walk away with our own ideas. And most of you already have your own ideas. But this certainly adds to it. It might change your mind or add to it, add to those thoughts that you already have. Anyway, that's enough of me talking here. We're going to get into the show right now, and let's do this thing. The earliest evangelist to write after Paul, and after the events of the war, he told his readers that after Jesus argued with the Jewish authorities in the temple, in quotation, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." Then Jesus asked him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down. Now, that was my Jesus voice, by the way. Now, many Christian apologists convince believers that this statement is an actual prophecy about the temple's destruction in the summer of 70 CE. Now, other scholars believe that maybe the author for Mark predicted the prophecy and was writing during the events of the war, and the Roman victory was inevitable. Basically, sitting there in a lawn chair watching it go down, and yeah, I think the Romans are pretty much going to tear this shit down to the ground and write about it. While others, including myself, believe that this author and Christian evangelist wrote a few years after the war, perhaps even after Josephus released his Jewish Wars in 75 CE. The passage, "Tell us, when will this be, teacher? And what will be the signs that all things are about to be accomplished?" Now, this author was well aware that the temple and its city were already destroyed and that many Jews are still rounding up fighters for round two of the war. Like many of his contemporaries, Mark interpreted the destruction of the temple as God's judgment, not just on Judaism, which in fact was broken, but specifically radical and messianic Judaism. In this author's eyes, he metaphorically and symbolically used the execution of his Jesus in his story to criticize the Jewish leaders that were rising up against Rome, as well as the Jewish elite who were corrupting the temple, as well as the entire religion. But the Jewish authorities in Mark's narrative were not only victims of the war, because the Jerusalem church too was destroyed. Not just the Holy Temple and the city. Even though those who had killed Jesus deserved their punishment, in Mark's view, but what about the innocent who suffered, such as the young, the women, the children, and the elderly? Mark's solution was actually twofold. One was to emphasize Jesus' own suffering and death, and two, to absolve himself from the charge that he failed to warn his followers of the coming destruction. Because anyone reading or hearing Mark's gospel, the events have long come and gone. There surely were questions. Why didn't Jesus tell them? Why didn't he save them? Now, Mark's Jesus, he wasn't a national messiah who would establish a kingdom by divine power. He was the crucified one who would endure suffering and expected the same from his followers. Now, indeed, it was precisely because he suffered that he would be victorious and return as the Son of Man, just so that he can come back and punish his foes. Even Paul in his ministry advocated a similar kind of Christology. However, he did not write a gospel. Mark did, and therefore needed some literary models for his suffering hero. He would find some partial inspiration in the Greek Bible, the Septuagint, in order to demonstrate that his Jesus is way better than the old and out-of-date prophets of Judaism that were causing so much corruption and war. The Passion narrative, for example, is filled with allusions to Psalms or lamentations to Isaiah's suffering servant. But Mark's primary inspiration for his narrative was Homer's presentation of Odysseus as the much enduring and as a man of many sorrows, ill-fated above all men. Homer established suffering as a dominant, primary theme throughout his epic. And he begins in the opening lines. "Many the woes who suffered in his heart upon the sea, seeking to win his own life and the return of his comrades." Now also, The Odyssey is rife with predictions of suffering that employ some form of the Greek verb to suffer. Now, Homer applied these expressions to Odysseus, who's the main character, throughout the entire epic. As in the opening lines that I just cited, as well as having many hardships. And in many cases, combining the two in order to say, to suffer many things. Now, the Greek evangelist that authored the book of Mark, he used a similar expression whenever referring to as Jesus' suffering. And in the first of the so-called passion predictions, he says this, "The Son of Man must suffer many things." And that's only because Scripture says so, referring back to Isaiah 53, which had nothing to do with the suffering servant, but that's another story. But the use of the two words in Greek that he uses for son of, it establishes no genetic connection. And his expression might perhaps have just been commonplace in literature at the time. But the phrase never appears in the Greek Septuagint, never appears in anything that Philo does, and appears only three times in all of Josephus. But Odysseus' suffering were all the more tragic in light of his nobility. Though he was mortal, Odysseus receives way more divine epithets than any other hero in Homer's epics, whether it's the Iliad or the Odyssey, including the epithet Born of Zeus, which was applied to Odysseus 8 times in the Iliad and 14 times to all Homeric heroes combined. And in the epics, this epithet refers not to Zeus as the hero's immediate sire or male parent, but rather as an ancestor. Because several times, Homer indicates that Odysseus was like a god. And whenever Homer likened his heroes to a god, he had in mind physical beauty, not moral or spiritual qualities or divine parentage for that matter. But Homer's Hellenistic readers sometimes viewed Odysseus the same as they did other heroes, as superhuman. In fact, many ancients also considered Odysseus to be the epitome of all moral life and standards. To cynics, he was an example of the self-sufficient individual, accustomed to misery and pain, a king in rags of sorts, willing to sacrifice his own comfort for the common good of man, and preferring wise Penelope to the beautiful and immortal Calypso. And even Stoics, people who could tolerate pain and suffering, saw in him intelligence, courage, adaptability, and endurance. Reason to elevate him to the model as a kind of Stoic pilgrim's progress. And even Seneca wrote, "We Stoics have declared that this Odysseus and Hercules were wise men because they were unconquered by struggles, were despisers of pleasure, and victors over all terror." To rhetoricians or orators, Odysseus was the eloquent wandering philosopher, the wisest and the best of all the Greeks. Now, Christians later would compare Jesus' crucifixion to Odysseus' being lashed to the mast of his own ship as he sailed past the Sirens. In the Christian Apocrypha, the Acts of Andrew that we talked about before, similarly depicted Andrew as a Christianized Odysseus, lashed to his cross at the edge of the sea, while he preached against pleasures and encouraged the crowd to join him in his journey to his true home, heaven. There were other comparisons between Andrew and Odysseus all throughout the Acts. So when we look at the suffering of Mark's hero, being that of Jesus, well, it looks very similar to the suffering found in Homer's Odysseus. Let's look at it, because both faced supernatural opposition. For Odysseus, it was Calypso, Circe, Poseidon, and Polyphemus. Whereas for Jesus, it was Satan, demons, and a wild demoniac or two, depending if you're reading Mark or Matthew, right? Each traveled with incompetent companions who were unable to endure the hardships of the journey. Both returned to a home that was infested with rivals who would attempt to kill him as soon as they recognized who he was. Also, both heroes in the stories go to Hades and return alive. But Jesus' suffering was and had to be way more extreme than Odysseus, in order to make the literary and political point. When Homer's hero returned to Ithaca, he slew his opponents. But when Jesus returned to Judea, his opponents slew him. But when it came down to Jesus' actual crucifixion and his burial, well, this author for Mark chose to abandon the Odyssey and instead borrowed from a combination of some Jewish scripture and books 22 and 24 of the Iliad, where we look at the death and the burial of another one of Homer's suffering heroes, Hector. Whereas Hector died and his soul descended down to Hades forever, Jesus, on the other hand, arose on the third day. And the reader knows that someday he will return just to punish his enemies and reward the faithful. But what the author for Mark did was use Odyssean imagery in order to express this hope. It's like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. Among Jesus' sufferings was his rejection when he returned to his fatherland, where the local residents knew him as the carpenter, the son of Mary and the brother of James and Joses, and Judas and Simon. But when they heard him teaching in the synagogues, they were astounded and asked themselves, where did this man get all this information? What is the wisdom that has been given to him and such deeds of power accomplished by his hands? Now, Mark's readers, they know exactly how to answer these questions. Because Jesus has this wisdom and power because he was not merely a carpenter. He was the Son of God. Jesus did not say this to his countrymen directly. Rather, he claimed only to be a prophet instead. A prophet is not without honor, except in his fatherland, and among his own relatives in his own house. Mark 6:4. Now, there are several aspects of this passage that parallel Homer's depiction of Odysseus, whom the distant Phaeacians honored as if he were a god. But when he returned to his home, he suffered abuse, humiliation, and dishonor. 34 times when Homer spoke about Odysseus' return to his home, he employed the text, to his fatherland, just like Mark uses, which is very similar to Mark's. Jesus returned to his fatherland. Furthermore, when Homer describes Odysseus' abuse at home, he often uses the same term that Mark did for his Jesus. The king of Ithaca was not without honor, except in his fatherland, among his own kin, and in his own house. Now, as you can imagine, Christian scholars routinely treat Mark's identification of Jesus being a carpenter as historically accurate, historically reliable, because there's no apparent reason for it. Why would he make it up? Especially because it could have actually been embarrassing, as illustrated by alterations in the other Gospels, and squeamish of later traditions. But Jesus may have been a carpenter, but our counter-hero Odysseus also just happened to be a crafty woodworker as well. In fact, it was Odysseus who had invented the Trojan horse and even built his very own palace. In fact, Homer went to great lengths to illustrate Odysseus' skills with his hands in order to symbolize his intelligence. Woodworking gave him foresight and clever resourcefulness. One first learns of Odysseus' carpentry when he builds a ship at the home of Calypso. She gave him a very bronze axe that fit his grip, both blades well honed, with a fine olive haft lashed firm to its head. She gave him a polished smoothing axe as well, and then she led the way to the island's outer edge where the trees grew tall. Alders, black poplars, and firs that shot sky high, seasoned, drying for years. Ideal for easy floating. Once she shown her guests where the tall timbers stood, Calypso, the lustrous goddess, headed home again. He set to cutting trunks. The work was done in no time. 20 in all felled. He trimmed them clean with his axe and split them deftly, trued them straight to the line. Meanwhile, the radiant goddess brought him drills. He bored through all his planks and wedged them snugly, knocking them home together, locked with pegs and bolts. Broaden the beam and bottom flats, as a merchantman when a master carpenter turns out her hull. So broad the craft Odysseus made himself. Working away at speed, he put up half decks, pinned close-set ribs, and swept of gunwales, rounded off the sides. He fashioned a mast and sank its yard deep, and added a steering oar to hold her straight on course. Then he fenced her stern with twigs and wicker, bulwark against the sea surge, floored with heaps of brush. Also, at the end of the epic, Homer emphasized Odysseus's masterful carpentry. He had a great drill. He had an amazing saw. He even had one of those table saws that could rip lumber in two. Because he had given so much care to every single detail of his magnificent estate, all the way down to the individual posts. The quote says, "He sat down upon the ashwood threshold within the doorway, leaning upon the doorpost of cypress, which of an old carpenter, Odysseus himself, had so skillfully planned, and true to its line." So the recognition scene with Penelope trades on his carpentry so far as he demonstrates his identity by describing his elaborately crafted wooden bed, which no other man ever seen before, and which he made himself. Now for Homer, Odysseus' handy craftsmanship reinforced his intelligence, his resourcefulness, and his wit about him. Because in Homer's day, carpentry was a metaphor for wisdom. The opposite in the case with Mark, where this author emulated Homer's crafty Odysseus by making his Jesus even wiser and way more powerful. Jesus' neighbors recognized him as a carpenter, but his wisdom and his ability to perform miracles far exceeded anything that Odysseus could ever do in Homer's epic. People in Mark's story were constantly amazed at how smart he was and how much he knew. He was teaching the priests in the temple, people that were twice his age. He's like a teenager. But despite these differences, our guy Mark here, just like Homer, depicted his hero as a wise and powerful carpenter who had less honor in his homeland than anywhere else. Other than Mark's Jesus would return to judge all the living and the dead, of course, and take the throne of eternity somewhere up in the heavenly clouds there. And that's pretty huge, right? Way better than anything that Odysseus could ever do. Odysseus can't walk on water. But once Mark linked the suffering of Jesus to that of Odysseus, he found in the epic a reservoir of literary landscapes to pull from. Brand new characterizations and type scenes, plot devices, all useful for crafting his narrative. But that's enough about talking about wood for now. But what about those foolish, incompetent companions of Jesus? So why do we call these disciples uncomprehending buffoons or foolish? Because more than any other gospel writer, Mark depicts his Jesus' disciples as these fearful and unfaithful, untrusting and uncomprehending buffoons. Even though Jesus had told them explicitly about the mystery of God's rule and his power, they still repeatedly demonstrated their failure to understand. For example, Jesus turns one slice of bread into like 1,000 loaves. And the disciples go, "Holy crap! Wow! How did you do that?" Or he turns one fish into like 5,000 fish. "Oh my God! Did you see what he just did? How did you do that, Jesus?" But in this little select group of friends, four of them were fishermen. But when they were tossed about in a storm at sea, well, they all completely lost their shit as if they've never seen a boat before. They were absolutely helpless. And then our hero, Jesus here, even had to force the 12 to go get into their boat and go sail without him. So they're out there at sea and they're floating around. And then they see this phantom walking on the waves, only to realize that, hey, that's Jesus walking on the water right there. Then they also quickly forgot that he can multiply loaves of bread, multiply fish, and couldn't understand why he must suffer and die, even though he's told him 1,000 times. And they argued with each other constantly about who is the best disciple. And they competed for privileged places in the afterlife. And pretty much just squabbled like little children. Also, one of the 12 betrayed Jesus by turning him over to the authorities. And at his arrest, just when he needed him most, or needed them most, the remaining 11 ran away in fear. They'd like totally fucking bailed on him. Jesus is like, "Bros, where are you going?" Then Peter, Jesus's secondhand man. You guys all know the story. Not once, not twice, not three times, denied ever knowing Jesus. Nope, never heard of him. Never seen of him before. No. The guy with the robe and the beard, white complexion. Nope. Never seen him before. They all proved to be greedy, cowardly, potentially treacherous, and above all, foolish, unable to understand and respond as they should have been able to. Now, such harsh, strange, bizarre treatment of the disciples. It's purely Mark in creation, where his successors, Matthew and Luke, oddly and repeatedly delete all of those scenes. Anything disparaging, all those passages found in Mark, who is their primary source. Or they simply adjust those passages just a little bit, enough to improve the disciples' apostolic reputations. Why? Because to Mark, his gospel was an epic. It wasn't just an epic, it was a new epic, an updated epic, like Homer's Odyssey and the Iliad, only better with a more powerful hero, functioning as an anti-epic. Whereas Matthew and Luke seemingly missed all of Mark's clever literary nuances. Or maybe they did, and just tried to disprove all of it. But for years now, New Testament scholars have proposed several reasons for Mark being such an asshole, so hostile to his disciples in his story, or members of the Jerusalem church for being adherents of an antiquated theology, or those who emphasize Jesus' miracles at the expense of the cross, or the apostles themselves as spreaders of unacceptable tradition. But Mark's depiction of the disciples is not consistently derogatory. This is important. From start to finish, it's not consistently derogatory. Because let's face it, they did in fact drop everything they had and follow Jesus. They got to receive the secret of the kingdom of God. They got to exercise authority over demons and even got to heal the sick. One of them figured it out and recognized that Jesus was the Messiah, and three of them even got to witness Jesus' transfiguration and glory. Four of them got to hear his predictions about the future events to come. And 11 of them were supposed to meet the risen Jesus in Galilee. And Mark 13, verses 9 through 13, implies that after the resurrection, the disciples proclaimed the gospel widely. Widely. And then were even persecuted for it. Had Mark wanted to demolish apostolic reputations, he could have done so way more thoroughly than this. Now, there are other scholars that have simply attributed Mark's complex, strange, weird, and mean depiction to the memory of the virtues and the vices of the actual historical 12 dudes. So, memory. While others have sought to ascribe it to a discrepancy between pre-Markan tradition and a Markan redaction by later editors and scribes, and attributing the positive depictions to a tradition and the negative and disparaging passages to Mark's later redactors. Now, as promising as all this sounds, I'm sure, its execution has proved to be highly subjective. Because several literary critics insisting on interpreting the text as we have it without appeal to the isolation of pre-Markan tradition have suggested that the author wishes his reader to identify with the humanity of the 12 guys and with their potential for being good or evil. And in this way, Mark may have challenged his readers to decide, well, what kind of disciple do I want to be? Do I want to be loyal? Do I want to be greedy? Do I want to be fearful? So on and so forth. So the debate over Mark's nutty disciples continues and may never be resolved. But with the comparison of the gospel next to the Odyssey, it suggests quite an eloquent solution filled with motive and availability. Because after the destruction of the temple, well, Christians, as you can imagine, had lots of questions and concerns. Think about it. For decades, Paul's Christians were waiting for Jesus to come and take everyone to heaven and to get ready for it because Jesus is coming any day now. Meanwhile, Paul's congregations, including Paul himself, are dying. And guess what? There's still no Jesus to speak of. Where are they going? Are they burning in hell? Are they being saved? Because supposedly, according to Paul, we're waiting for Jesus to show up to save us all in our lifetime. Now, Mark's gospel satisfies this problem with Jesus already having come and gone, and will return when he's good and ready. His motive was primarily to denounce the Jews who brought death and destruction to millions. And both the Romans and radical Jews were equally responsible. We can see motifs where he is criticizing both and Homer. It's aimed at the Romans, while the Holy Scripture is aimed at the Jews. Criticizing war in general. Mark was kind of a Switzerland, if you would. His gospel in whole was an anti-war document and blaming both sides of it. Now, Homer highlighted Odysseus' endurance. He highlighted his courage and his infinite wisdom by contrasting him with other characters, especially the comrades who sailed with him, specifically those from Troy in books 9 through 12. Odysseus's Nostos. Homer lost no time in establishing the foolishness of Odysseus's crew as a major theme of the epic. Oh, the many pains he suffered, heartsick on the open sea, fighting to save his life and bring his comrades home. But he could not save them from disaster, hard as he strove. The reckless of their own waves destroyed them all, the blind fools. Now, with respect to Homer's tale, although these men were hardened, badass veterans of the Trojan War, the enormous difficulties they faced during their Nostos produced terror and frequent weeping amongst them all. Many of their problems, however, were brought on to themselves through their own notorious stupidity, which increases in intensity and gravity, and pertains above all to their bellies. One classicist described Odysseus's comrades as stupid, crude, silly men. Many were certainly inferiors, shivering with fear and getting into constant trouble, says Charles Rowan Bay. And this statement sounds equally just like the disciples depicted by Mark. Now, there are four additional characteristics of Mark's disciples that also resemble those of Odysseus's crew, both in Odysseus's Nostos and Mark's story about Jesus. And Nostos, I used the word before, is basically when a hero returns home by sea in ancient Greek literature. But in both stories presented by Homer and Mark, the narrator first presents the hero's entourage favorably, and then gradually over time, starts to introduce evidence of their incompetence, until in the end, they all fail together. And then second, Homer and Mark both treat the hero's crew as unified, a unified functioning group. There are a few individuals in either group that have distinguishing traits about them, and each group as a whole develop its unity almost exclusively in relation to the hero. And third, both followers failed because they, unlike the hero himself, being Jesus or Odysseus, simply could not endure the hardships. And then fourth, Mark Simon Peter seems to play a pivotal role that looks just like Eurylochus, Odysseus's right-hand man, just like Simon Peter to Jesus. In another episode, we'll talk about how Mark Simon Peter also portrays one of the leaders of the rebellion in Josephus' Jewish Wars, but that's another story altogether. Now, when a reader is first introduced to Eurylochus, well, his description suggests that he was nearly Odysseus's peer as a hero, and even godlike, as well as great-hearted. But soon after a while, one's impressions of Eurylochus steadily begin to deteriorate. Little more, little more, little more. And in contrast to Odysseus, Eurylochus does everything possible in order to avoid all danger at all cost and suffering. Eurylochus is set up by the narrator to represent the craven attitude towards life. No other character speaks on behalf of the crew, for it is he who opposes Odysseus on behalf of all the others, who, like himself, are incapable of enduring any hardships whatsoever. For example, as their ship sailed past the island of Thrinacia, Eurylochus complained to Odysseus that he and the rest of the crew will not continue their voyage until they all get to enjoy a hot meal as well as a good night's sleep. Then at dawn, once we're fed and once we're rested, goddammit, then I promise we'll shove off. And against his better judgment, Odysseus caves in, But he made them promise to not even look at, don't touch, and definitely don't slay the cattle sacred to the sun that grazed on the island. This delay, however, was their undoing, because the god Zeus sent them a navigable weather, ultimately postponing their departure for an entire month, so long that they exhausted all the supplies that Circe had given them. But then when hunger began to pinch their bellies, Eurylochus convinced the rest of the crew that there was no death worse than starving on an island that was swarming with roastable livestock. So while Odysseus was sleeping, well, the crew snuck out, and they killed a few of the sacred cattle. Yes, they did. They were told not to, but they did so anyway. To punish their audacity, the god Zeus decides to drown them all later on when they were finally out to sea, forcing Odysseus to complete his voyage and face his rivals at home without their help. Now, when one takes that story and then mines through Mark's gospel, well, in similarity, the reader at first really favors Peter. He's really a good dude. We all like him. He's a great character. He had left everything, his family, his home, everything, to go fish for humans. You remember, follow me and become fishers of men, which has another story built all around that one too, which we can talk about later. And he was the very first character, apart from demons and devils, to recognize Jesus' true identity. He didn't speak for just himself, but like Eurylochus, he too spoke for the entire crew, all 12. But soon after time, one's view of Peter begins to change a little bit, over a series of disputes over things like suffering. For example, Mark has his Jesus order the disciples to don't publicize Peter's recognition of him. And then for the first time, warn the crew that he must suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and the scribes, and then be killed. Then after 3 days, he gets to rise again. Mark 8:31. So now Jesus just dropped this entire bomb on Peter's lap. Hey, so it looks like, I'm going to suffer. I'm going to die. I'm going to be murdered. But it's okay. I'm going to be back in a few days. All's going to be cool. So how did Peter deal with this statement? Well, he dealt with it with a complaint, similar to Eurylochus's, on hearing that the ship is not going to stop at Thrinacia. Because both characters, Peter and Eurylochus, challenged the authority of the heroes, Jesus and Odysseus, objecting to their seriousness about the heroes' doomsday predictions. Eurylochus rebuked Odysseus for not taking pity on his hungry crew, who simply could not endure such suffering.
So spoke Eurylochus, and the rest of my comrades gave assent. Then it was that I realized that some god was assuredly devising ill.
Now, Peter could not understand a Messiah that has to suffer and die. Although, because scripturally he was supposed to, Isaiah 52:53. But turning and looking at his disciples, Jesus rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan! For you are setting your mind not in divine things, but on human things. Satan!" Mark 8:33. Now, if Mark had in mind here Eurylochus' complaint, then maybe he may have taken here to refer not to a god, as in Homeric Greek, but instead to a demon who had prompted Eurylochus and others to seek short-term comforts versus the suffering and death. A demon had beguiled Eurylochus, whereas in Mark, Satan beguiled Simon Peter. Eurylochus could not accept Odysseus's tolerance for hunger.
Likewise,
Peter could not tolerate Jesus having to suffer. And then at the Last Supper in Mark's story, Jesus predicted that everybody would leave him. And Peter swore that he would never abandon his Lord. In quotation, "Even though I must die with you, Lord, I will not deny you."
And then basically all the 11, remaining 11, said this very same thing.
And then the next episode, however, demonstrates the weakness of their determination as they were unable to stay awake while Jesus was agonizing in prayer. And then all the disciples fled. They just took off, poof, when Jesus got arrested.
Just like when the cops would pull up when you were drinking beer in the park.
And Peter, when later confronted by a maidservant and a bystander, well, what did he do? He denied ever knowing Jesus. It would not be Simon Peter to bear that cross, but another Simon altogether, Simon of Cyrene. Just like Eurylochus and the rest of Odysseus's fickle crew, Peter and the rest of the disciples broke their vows to the hero in the face of suffering, in the face of danger, in the face of death. Jesus, just like Odysseus, had to confront his opponents alone. Now in the story, Homer obviously didn't harbor any hostility or hatred for Eurylochus or any of Odysseus's crew. They were, after all, simply fictitious people that he had invented. They didn't exist. He depicted them negatively merely to enhance, by comparison, the wisdom, the courage, and the self-control that Odysseus had. Same with the author for the Mark and Gospel with his Jesus. The next most admirable characters are the disciples. When our first gospel writer, Mark, portrays the disciples in a negative light, he doesn't do it because it's something that happened in real life. Rather, he does so in order to contrast their vices with their virtues of Jesus, especially when it comes to his capacity, his ability for suffering. Although the 12 may be symbols for objectional theology, they surely are foils for a heroic Christology that praises the suffering hero at the expense of his inept associates.
This has been a Skeptical Ghost Heathen production, motherfuckers.